This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Got your pencils and notebooks ready? Hope so, because today we start in school where districts across the Commonwealth are struggling to find people to staff classrooms thanks to COVID-related absences. It has gotten so bad in some districts that superintendents and principals are stepping up to fill the void. In a moment, we're actually going to hear from one such superintendent, and we will take your calls. Are you seeing staff shortages in your school district as a parent, teacher, administrator? What does learning look like right now in your school district? The number 800-423-8255, that's 1-800-423-TALK, or tweet us at Radio Boston. First, to join us with a bird's eye view of staffing shortages statewide, WBUR education reporter Carrie Young. Welcome back, Carrie.
Hi, Tiziana. Happy to be here.
So, Carrie, I'm going to ask you the big question. How bad is it right now in Massachusetts?
Ooh, I mean, it was pretty bad, especially those first few weeks of the month when the surge really hit ahead. You know, some student absence rates were 40 to 50%, depending on the school. And then as we're talking about staff outages and staff shortages, I know in the first 2 weeks of January, the state recorded about 7,000 teachers and school staff who were positive for COVID and had to be out sick. Now, obviously, the teacher outage rate did vary from district to district, but in a lot of places, they are taking some, you know, pretty extreme measures, as you mentioned. You know, principals were in classrooms. The idea was like, let's just put a responsible adult in each classroom. That was the goal until they could get through things.
So in many of the other stories, Carrie, we've done on staffing shortages, what we hear is COVID is exacerbating a pre-existing staffing shortage. True here as well or not?
So yes and no. When it comes to teacher shortages in general in Massachusetts, we fare much better than the rest of the country. When it comes to substitute teacher shortages, that's a very different story. Pre-COVID, it was a thing. Districts were having a really hard time finding substitute teachers on a regular basis when someone had to be out. The problem tended to be worse in urban districts compared to suburban or even rural districts. One thing that I have heard working for a lot of schools they've been using now is, you know, it's essentially like improving working conditions, improving, you know, the benefits that are guaranteed. So what some schools are doing is they're hiring on these like kind of permanent subs, or they're these people who are there full-time benefits, but they have kind of a flex job. So if people are out, they act as a sub. If everyone's in, then they, you know, use those people to do whatever else needs to be done, help out with the school function, what have you. There are some things that people are experimenting with, but it was a worsening problem. And just like we've seen so many times before, COVID just made it that much worse.
So I understand you've really dived in with a couple of districts in how they're handling the shortage.
I did. Yeah, I got really lucky. I talked to Larry Wolpe in Framingham, the principal at the Potter Road Elementary School, and he agreed to do some audio diaries for me, you know, as he made his way through the surge. And it was the kind of thing where he would wake up and do it in the morning. And that's usually right when he would get the message that, you know, someone was out. So here is one of his audio diaries, and you could just hear the exhaustion in his voice.
6:12 on Thursday morning, January 13th. And sure enough, that first text came in from my assistant principal saying, "Hey, somebody's not coming in, so we're officially shorthanded." The struggle is real and it continues.
Yeah, the districts I checked with, including in Framingham, you know, they've taken multiple ways to cover the shortages. In Boston, we've heard of, you know, even the superintendent covering a fifth grade classroom, assistant principals covering classrooms. In Framingham, Principal Larry Wolpe did say that, you know, there were a couple of times that, or often, he's had to pull from classrooms that usually should have multiple adults, which really isn't ideal.
We've had situations where our English as a second language teachers have been pulled out to cover for classroom teachers. We've had special education teachers who were pulled out to cover for classroom teachers. It's a conundrum. You're sort of constantly robbing Peter to pay Paul.
Yeah, and again, you know, he makes a really good point of robbing Peter to pay Paul. It's not ideal to pull these adults out of the classrooms that they were in. They were designed to have multiple adults in them because they're higher needs students. So when he needs to pull someone out, you know, that means student learning can really take a hit.
So it's been bad. Fortunately, we are hearing from public health officials the current surge is waning. There may be some relief. Are there long-term solutions to this situation?
When it comes to these massive outages, I haven't heard any great, you know, really like substantive plans that have come out. I did hear, for example, that several teachers' colleges are stepping up to say, listen, like Harvard Graduate School, I got an email recently. The Harvard Grad School for Education is encouraging their students to apply for substitute teaching roles if they happen to have some free time in their schedule. So that's one thing that's happening. Otherwise, you know, in more quote-unquote normal times, I know more districts are trying to take up that model of having those full-time flex employees. But when so many people are out, when there is a surge like this in COVID, I haven't heard any great long-term solutions to this.
Well, I know you'll keep watching it, and we'll keep watching what you tell us. WBUR education reporter Carrie Young. Carrie, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
So, south of Boston, in Brockton, school officials are also dealing with staffing shortages. They are in such dire need of competent substitutes that they've raised their hourly rates to attract more. What about you? Is your school district also facing staffing shortages because of COVID? Are you a parent of a kid who's been sent home because there's no one to watch them in the classroom? Maybe you're a teacher. What are you seeing in your classrooms and school hallways? 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also tweet us at Radio Boston. Joining us now is Michael Thomas, and he is the superintendent of Brockton Public Schools. Superintendent Thomas, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. Nice to be here.
I understand, Superintendent, that you are living this problem in the Brockton schools. In fact, filled in a classroom yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't teach a full class, but I've been in schools helping with hall duty. I had a cover for a directed academic for a little while, and then just was throughout the building, mostly at Brockton High School, wherever the principal needed us. And me, not only me, but several district level administrators did that as well.
How did it feel to stand in the classroom that day in that capacity?
Well, I'm in schools a lot, so it's not like it's not something that's foreign to me. So, but it's, you know, it's not a good feeling when, you know, you don't have, you know, when several staff members are out and students need to be in studies, they're not, they're obviously not getting direct services from their teacher. So, you know, it's very difficult. So in that aspect, it wasn't a good feeling, but in the aspect of actually being with kids and the energy that they bring, it was always a good thing.
I know you are always trying to do right by kids in your district, of course. With this kind of shortage between Omicron and the substitute teacher shortage, can you right now do right by the students the way you want to?
No. No, it's very difficult. And I was listening to the report before I came on, is that it is difficult when you're pulling teacher aides and paraprofessionals who usually work with English language learners or students with disabilities, and you have to pull them to cover other classrooms. You're not delivering the services that, you know, our students need. And also for when you talk about students and there's not enough staff and they all have to, you know, they miss class, they miss English or math or one of their other subjects because they have to sit in a cafeteria and not have direct instruction. You know, obviously that is not, that's not, you know, a good way to deliver educational services.
How does that make you feel?
It's frustrating. But on the other hand, I really appreciate the community of Brockton and the staff here for always pitching in and doing whatever we can to keep schools open. So I think it's really important for us to continue to keep schools open. We were a district that went all the way last year up until March, fully remote, and the hybrid wasn't much better. So, even though this year has been very, very difficult, I think even more difficult than last year, it's still very important to have in-person learning and have the kids in school.
So you're not itching for the state to loosen its requirements and allow some kind of return to remote learning?
No. I would say that if you had to do that for maybe 1 or 2 days when you really, like I had to close Brockton High School the 2 days after the holiday break. Because we just didn't have enough staff, even with, you know, trying to get extra staff from across the district that at Central to go cover at Brockton High School. It's a school of 4,000 students. It's got 350,000 square feet of floor space. So if you're not accurately staffed, then you can't safely have school and deliver education. So we had to close for the Monday and Tuesday after the holiday break. It would have been nice to be able to switch those 2 days to remote learning. We've been able to check in with the students after the holiday break, and teachers would have been able to deliver their instruction in a safe way. And even if they were quarantined, they could have we could have worked something out where they could have, you know, been teaching remotely. So I wouldn't have minded it for 1 or 2 days or even 5 days, but I wouldn't want it beyond that.
But a little flexibility from the state would actually have helped you solve your problem.
Yes. For that first 2 weeks after the holiday break, it would have been very helpful.
I'd like to pick up a phone call here. We've got Max calling in Boston. Max, go ahead.
Hi, I'll try to be brief. So I teach in a suburban high school of about 1,700 students, and I think we've solved this problem 3 years ago.
How?
We did away with subs altogether. Now, this wouldn't work in all high schools. And so what we do is in 10th, 11th, and 12th grade, we have open campus for students. So they don't have study hall where they have to call the roll and be there. For 9th graders, when a teacher's out during a study hall, they go to the cafeteria where they're monitored by teachers who have that duty.
Thanks for that call, Max. Let me turn back to Superintendent Michael Thomas. Flexibility in design like that, have you already started those kinds of changes? You know, your thought on that particular design? I mean, what can you do?
Oh, yeah, we've been doing that for years, what he just mentioned. I mean, we have open campus for students, juniors and seniors. And some students that don't, if it's a junior or senior that don't, if they don't have a first period or last period class, we have the open campus model where they can come in late and go home early. We do have that model where if there's teachers out, and we call it teachers absent without a sub, they either go to a study hall or they go to the cafeteria, and they can work on their classwork on their laptops, and they're supervised by a teacher. It's called directed academics. I worked at the high school for 10 years. I left there in 2010 at Brockton High, but we've been doing that at the Brockton High School probably since, you know, early 2000s. So that's something we've always had. But again, I'm dealing with 4,000 students and 350 staff members. So, you know, those models are great and we use all of them. But coming back from the vacation at Brockton High alone, we had 80 people out between teachers and support staff the first 2 days back. And, you know, you can, even with directed academics and people watching students in the cafeterias, there's still not enough adults in the building to safely have school.
So we spoke with a substitute teacher in Tewksbury Public Schools named Rosalind Impink. She fills in when she's home on break from college. She talked to us about how technology, even when you're not working remotely, technology can help in this situation. Here she is.
I think that technology has been such a game changer, especially for these kids who have such advanced technology literacy, far more than I ever had at that age. And so even if their teacher is out, they're still able to post lessons and post assignments for their students to find on Google Classroom and submit to them. So the continuity of learning and the continuity of school is still there.
What's the next game changer? What else would really change the game for you?
Oh, is that for me or is that
for
still
you?
There?
Sorry, Superintendent Thomas. What would really change the game for you?
No, I think, again, the technology we have is great. You know, before the pandemic, we were not a one-to-one school district. Now all of our students have laptops, and us, we also give out Wi-Fi devices if they need Wi-Fi at home. The technology has been great. I mean, it's helped us with after-school tutoring virtually. It's been so helpful. And again, we have teachers that do post those assignments. But I'm going to say it again, and this is where I agree with the state, that there's no substitute for in-person learning. I mean, you can post assignments after assignments, and that might be good for 1 or 2 days. But beyond that, there's just no substitute as the interaction a teacher has with a student on a day-to-day basis. And that's everything. That's them supporting them social, emotionally. It's giving them extra help when they need it. It's, you know, recognizing maybe issues they have that we could help them with, or lead them to places where they can get extra support. So again, having those online options and those kind of things is great, but there's still no substitute for in-person learning.
And that is Michael Thomas, superintendent of Brockton Public Schools. Superintendent Thomas, thank you.
Thank you.
Slammed hospitals, school bus driver shortages, vaccine distribution, just a few places that the Commonwealth has used the National Guard. In fact, as hospitals were slammed with COVID cases in December, Governor Baker called on 500 National Guard members to enter hospitals to lend a hand. He added 500 more this month to bolster the support. He tipped his hat to Guard members at the last State of the Commonwealth speech Governor Baker delivered on Tuesday.
I just want to say how proud we are of all you do. Thank you for your service, and you make us so much better than we would be without you.
So get this. This is actually the 14th activation of the National Guard in the Commonwealth since March of 2020. They've been, as I said, driving school buses, helping at vaccination sites, supporting medical staff, many corners of the Commonwealth. Here to tell us a bit more about the Guard, their role in helping the state, National Guard members Major Vincent Mullen and Lieutenant Colonel Jeff Love. So I think I'm going to call you Major Mullen. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And Lieutenant Colonel Love, welcome to you as well.
Thank you, Tiziana.
So the Guard has been activated quite a few times during the pandemic. It seemed to be an endless amount of jobs the Corps has been called for. So what kind of responsibilities have you had in your time with the Guard during this special moment, Major Vincent Mullen?
Yes. Right now, I'm currently the Task Force XO. So there's a Lieutenant Colonel who's commanding it, and we got stood up in probably end of December to bring on those initial 500, and then subsequently the additional 500. So currently, we're at 1,000, and it was really working with our interagency partners, DPH, in identifying hospitals, ambulance services. We're into long-term care facilities and dialysis centers now. So it's really bringing the soldiers on and then making sure that we were able to support what was being asked of us for DPH.
And Major Mullen, where have you, if you have, found yourself on the ground serving during this pandemic?
So we've bounced around up here. Our headquarters, though, is in Worcester, but we've been out to see different hospitals and ambulance services throughout the time. So probably within the last 2 weeks, we've been able to bounce around a little bit more and see what our soldiers are and check in with the management of those facilities.
Lieutenant Colonel Love, you were a resident historian, and as Governor Baker started to activate the Guard, we started to wonder, how unusual is this? Is this part of the Commonwealth's National Guard tradition?
It is. We were established in 1636, and, our modern form of support to the governor really takes shape at statehood. And we really helped to pioneer this model of militia, and now called National Guard, support to the state, support to the Commonwealth whenever needed and wherever needed. So this really is part of our tradition that we've been performing for many generations.
And so stepping up like this, I hear you, and obviously at the start of the country, there were no school buses, so you wouldn't have been seeing school bus drivers in the 1600s. But this wide swath, Lieutenant Colonel, of the various things we are asking Guard members to do, is that typical as well?
The variety, I think we've gotten into some specific requirements that are novel, They're new. In particular, Operation Children First, where we supported the public school transportation needs in these communities, that's new. But really, over the last couple hundred years, we have seen a wide variety doing everything from the more traditional ice storms, snowstorms, blizzards, floods, to supporting Democratic and Republican national conventions or helping to search for missing persons. So there's always been a variety.
So Major Mullen, I want to come back to you in your task force role. What does it take to have a group of people ready to basically go do anything they're needed to do and do it well in a way that keeps people safe at any time? I can't even get my head around what that takes.
Yeah, it's I can say it's definitely lots of work, but it just kind of highlights the adaptability and the agility of the soldiers that come on, right? So they're already medically ready to go out. They're all vaccinated to go out to meet the requirements that the hospitals have asked of us. And then it takes, a lot of driving around the state, but once they get here, they in process, and then it's really just coordination between us and whatever agency we may be supporting and making sure that we can align soldiers to that location. So far, what we've heard back from a lot of them is it's been great. A lot of great relationships. The soldiers are listening and the airmen are listening and providing the support that's needed.
So what's something that a Guard member might be doing in a hospital today?
Sure, there's a couple things. Some of the main ones they're doing are, providing patient observer. They're helping out with security. They're also transporting patients from room to room, so in hospital transport, and they're also delivering meals and preparing those meals to assist the patients.
And does that take special training? You say people are medically ready, they're vaccinated to be called into these hospitals. Are there, I'm imagining school bus driving again in this case, are there, activations that require special training?
Yes. For this one, what we did to meet some of what the hospital was looking for is we provided them CPR refresher here before we actually pushed them out to any of the facilities. And then what we did is we coordinated with the facilities to sort of as if they were employees of those facilities is to have onboarding training as if they were hired with those facilities. So each of the facilities that had taken these soldiers, whether it was an ambulance service, making sure they understood how to drive the ambulance and how to lift people in and out or move people around the hospitals and the facilities were the ones that really trained them on their specific job that they were going to fulfill for the time on mission.
And how do they know when the job ends? I don't mean one day it's over. I mean, do people do this indefinitely and they don't know when they're going to stop doing this as Guard members?
Not necessarily. So we have a pretty set timeline now. That is always adjustable, but that's really based off of coordination with the governor and DPH and what the need of the community actually is. So if there's a continuing need, that would be something that, DPH would request and then the governor would support and we would still be here supporting that.
So coming back to you, Lieutenant Colonel Love, I'm not sure it's clear to most people how the Guard actually works. So how does this work? What does it mean to activate 500 members of the National Guard? What are they doing before they're activated?
Mm-hmm. So just kind of to step back a bit, the National Guard has a twofold mission. We're both a state organization, which serves the governor and provides the ready, effective resources that we've been, just hearing about when needs arise. But we also can enter a federal status when we serve the president by providing trained and ready units during times of war and national emergency. Now, when we're requested, when our resources are requested by cities and towns and approved by the Massachusetts Emergency Management Agency and the governor's call-up, it's a rapid process. There will be a muster and an assembly, at a rally point, typically a state armory, and there will be a series of readiness checks, inspections. You know, based on what the requirements of the mission are, equipment will be looked at. You know, everybody will go through a series of readiness checks, and you know, perhaps Major Mullen could tell us more about the specific ones here, but you know, it varies for each mission.
And prior to that muster, and I'm making this up on purpose, say that muster's on a Saturday, what was that person doing on Friday?
Well, we're citizen soldiers, so we're with our families, we're with our employers, you know, we're in the communities, we're your neighbors, and we get a phone call, and so we go where we're needed.
Major Mullen, that's really striking. We've thought a lot about the 500 and then the 500 people that the governor has activated, and he's praised the Guard for that service. But the whole community has to support a Guard member in offering that service then. Is that true?
That's extremely true. It goes down to the employers and the you know, their families as well as supporting. You know, the families have to sacrifice as well as the soldier and the employer when we're called. But
oh, Major Mullen, we lost you there. I'm sure we will get you back, but we just lost your sound. So do I still have you, Lieutenant Colonel Love?
I'm still here, Tiziana.
Great. Oh, and I think we got Major Mullen back. Do I have you back, Major Mullen?
I'm here.
Great. We lost your sound for a second. Please go ahead and finish your thought.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, it's 1,000 soldiers on this task force right now, and they've come from almost every town across the Commonwealth. So it's really, you know, like Colonel Love was saying, it we're neighbors, we're members of the community, and there's a sacrifice on both the employers and the family side for us to come in and do our job.
Lieutenant Colonel Love, I'm imagining that you love Guard history, since you're the resident historian. What's the one corner of Guard history that you'd love our listeners to know?
That's a good question. But I think that, you know, as especially after this last really intense, you know, 2 years of service to our communities and to the Commonwealth, the periods which have really attracted my attention has been the similarities and the differences with the Spanish flu influenza of 1918. You know, there again, we had several thousand of our members on duty during that second wave. And they were operating 10 field hospitals in Massachusetts, open-air hospitals, providing the best care possible for patients. And then here's the interesting thing. If you go even further back to the very start of our statehood, our very first important series of missions were for the yellow fever epidemic, which broke out in Boston and in the Northeast. And the militia was there assisting public authorities to control the movement in and out of cities to try and contain the contagion.
Well, there you go. A long, proud history of service. That's Lieutenant Colonel Jeff Love and Major Vincent Mullen, both of the National Guard. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
The effort to vaccinate the population against the coronavirus continues to be slow but steady. However, one demographic continues to lag: people who are pregnant. At the end of 2021, 63% of Americans were fully vaccinated. By comparison, only around 40% of pregnant adults were, according to data from the CDC. What makes this decision such a hard one for people who are expecting? We're going to talk about that, and we invite you to join the conversation. Are you pregnant and struggling with the decision to get a vaccine? What's holding you back? Or is someone in your life on the fence while expecting or planning to get pregnant? What questions do you have? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now, two people who have designed a training initiative to help medical professionals discuss the COVID vaccine with pregnant patients. We have Daniel Mullen, a clinical psychologist and associate professor in the Department of Family Medicine and Community Health at the UMass Chan Medical School. He also directs the Center for Integrated Primary Care there. And Dr. Stacy Potts, a physician specializing in family medicine and obstetrics and an associate professor of family medicine and community health at the UMass Chan Medical School as well. Dr. Potts, welcome.
Thank you.
And Professor Mullen, welcome to you as well.
Yes, thank you.
So I want to start by making sure that I understand what we know. So let me just ask if the following is correct. One, there is a growing body of evidence that shows that the vaccine is indeed safe for pregnant people and their babies. Two, COVID infection itself can be quite devastating during pregnancy and delivery. Three, COVID vaccines do not affect fertility. And also, what we don't know is if there are any long-term effects of the vaccine since it's only been available for a year now. Dr. Potts, is that all correct?
That is correct, yes.
And Professor Mullen, is that stipulated among most of the people that you talk with who are worried about vaccination and pregnancy?
No, not necessarily. I think, we see the full range of people with a full range of opinions about the vaccine. There's people coming in saying, yes, please give it to me right away. There are other people saying, no, never. So I think there's just as with the general population, with pregnant individuals, there's a range of thoughts and attitudes about the vaccination.
Dr. Potts, when you talk to a patient who is pregnant or planning to become pregnant who has concerns, what do you most often hear?
I think you hit on a lot of the concerns that patients have in terms of, is it safe? How important is it? Many pregnant people have had friends who have had very mild cases of COVID and so are less concerned about what COVID might mean for them. And so, as you pointed out in your highlights, I think explaining to them how really serious it can be during pregnancy is important. And then they do have concerns about fertility, as you raised, and also the risk of miscarriage or pregnancy complications related to the vaccine. And what I will say about all pregnant people is that they have a lot of opinions coming their direction. They have a lot of family members who have opinions about what they should do in their pregnancy. And of course, friends who, have made their own decisions that are quick to share them as well. And that's true in all decisions we make during pregnancy. But in this one, I think it's been particularly difficult given how new it is.
And Professor Daniel Mullen, you are a clinical psychologist. Talk about the psychological wear and tear of that pressure and of being, as Dr. Potts sort of explained, kind of in a bubble where lots of people have opinions about the decisions that you're making and the way you're taking care of your body.
Yeah, I mean, this is sort of the starting place of the training that the two of us have been doing together, is acknowledging that it's really normal for people to be ambivalent. It's really normal for people to feel conflicted. Part of them feels like, yes, maybe they should get the vaccine. They might also simultaneously feel like they shouldn't get it. And they can kind of feel like they're swinging back and forth on a pendulum. From a psychological perspective, the best thing that a doctor or a nurse can do is sort of begin by listening instead of beginning with lecturing. So finding out where is that person on this continuum and what reasons might the individual already have for why they think, yeah, maybe they should get this vaccine. The best approach is to let people, let the patients talk themselves about their ambivalence rather than trying to use fear or shame or lecturing them about this topic, or really any topic.
I just want to invite you to join the conversation. Are you pregnant and struggling with the decision to get a vaccine? Is someone in your life on the fence? Give us a call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Dr. Potts, I know you and Professor Mullen have designed this program together. He's saying if you start by allowing people to talk through their ambivalence, when one does that as a healthcare professional or someone supporting a person in pregnancy, what begins to unfold? Why is that such an important step?
I think that there's a lot of different reasons for people to be conflicted about this decision. And if we start by making assumptions about that, we can really, as Dr. Mullen said, start lecturing them in directions that are unnecessary for that particular patient. So what happens in that conversation is I get to understand the perspective of this particular person within their family and the context of their community and what they're thinking about as they're making this decision. And then I can target the information that I give them related to that decision and the conflict that they have. So, for example, somebody who has had miscarriages in the past and is very concerned about miscarriages will be, you know, may just have that fear. And if I talk to them about, you know, a whole bunch of other pieces of information when all they really need to hear is that the vaccine is safe and will not cause miscarriage, then that may be how to direct that conversation.
It's interesting to hear you talk about that, Dr. Potts. Professor Mullen, you said, you know, listen, begin by letting the person express their ambivalence. At one level, I find myself thinking, well, yeah, that makes perfect sense. You know, healthcare providers should do that. But is that challenging for healthcare providers to just sit and listen and allow the patient to express that ambiguity? Is that a challenge?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's challenging for a few reasons. One is that most healthcare providers will tell you that they don't have enough time with their patients. And, you know, listening does take time. I think most of the people I work with think that this topic is worth the time and should be prioritized. You know, another reason that it can be difficult for healthcare providers is that they care so passionately about their patients and their patients' safety. We know that COVID is now a leading cause of death amongst pregnant people. And the doctors who take care of pregnant people, they don't ever want to see one of their patients die. And so a lot of times if they're pressuring the patient, it's coming from a place of caring. It's coming from a place of compassion. What we're asking them to do is just to press pause on that, just to press mute on those concerns, and to first let the patient talk through their ambivalence before giving their advice or giving their recommendations.
Dr. Potts, I zeroed in there on Professor Mullen's point that COVID is now a leading cause of death among pregnant people. Why?
Well, because it's a serious illness in pregnancy, and pregnant women don't die that often. We actually, in the United States, have one of the higher maternal mortality rates, with about 700 women dying per year related during pregnancy. However, COVID, you know, in August alone related to the Delta variant, took 40 pregnant women's lives. And that was definitely the peak, but overall, we're getting up to 300 women who have been lost to this illness. And when you think about the impact of losing those lives to send a child home without a mother is just heart-wrenching and so difficult. So I think Dr. Mullen, you know, brings up a good point that we are very concerned and we don't want to lose any of our patients, especially for a vaccine-preventable illness. But the conversation is more than just convincing them to get the immunization. It's about building trust in the relationship. There's going to be a lot of decisions made during pregnancy, and I take each one of these conversations as a building block to a relationship more than pushing a decision on a woman. It is her autonomy that I need to protect more than anything, and building our trust and relationship.
And I really appreciate that explanation. I'm also going to flag that non-binary people and transgender women also can be pregnant. I know we don't have as much research in those spaces. Just flagging that, and I'm going to go to the phones here. We've got Samantha on the line in Nashua. Samantha, go ahead.
Oh, hi. I guess my question's a little off topic of pregnancy, but I actually have a 2-year-old, and I was wondering about breastfeeding and the vaccines when it comes to protecting my 2-year-old.
I appreciate that, Samantha. And Dr. Potts, I'll come back to you. Breastfeeding for Samantha, but also just postnatal care for the pregnant person and the baby. How do we think about that in the context of vaccination? And what about getting a vaccination right after pregnancy if one has not done so yet?
The evidence shows that vaccination is safe in the postnatal period and during breastfeeding. There is some limited evidence that that will likely build, that some of the immunity gained by being vaccinated does pass through breast milk, so it may provide some additional protection for the neonate, or 2-year-old in this case.
Okay, thank you for that. I want to grab another call here. We've got Carl in Taunton. Carl, go ahead.
Yes, hi. I want to share my experience with my niece, who was pregnant and just had her child. When she first got pregnant, the doctor advised her against taking the vaccine. That was probably around 9 months ago. And when they delivered the baby about a month ago, when they went into the hospital, the staff, the nurses, the doctors were pressuring them. They said to the point where it was too much to take the vaccine. And they say how safe it is and how safe it is for pregnant people. But at the same time, we've had the Johnson & Johnson vaccine become unrecommended, and we were told how safe that was. So, you know, where should people be with this?
Carl, thank you for that question. And Professor Mullen, I'm going to come back to you on this. In reading and preparing for today to talk with you, I saw so many articles that also talked about changes in public health messaging and how that does affect people's sense of assurance and trust. And you've talked about trust today while in this conversation, so pick up on that thread.
Yeah, I mean, so Dr. Potts and I are focused on helping doctors and nurses figure out how to speak to the patient that's sitting in front of them. And, you know, one of the things that we're advocating for is respecting the individual's autonomy, and not just thinking that, but actually saying it out loud, making sure the patient understands that you respect that this is their body and their decision. If they want to hear your advice, you're willing to offer that advice. But they need to be the one to make the decision. There's a little bit of a paradox here that the more people feel pressure, the more people feel coerced to do something, the more likely they are to dig in their heels and resist. And I think we're seeing some of that in the mandates related to vaccination out there. So I think what happens is well-intentioned doctors and nurses are coming in a little bit too strong with some people, like this caller is describing. And unfortunately, it often has the opposite effect.
Dr. Potts, I'll come back to you, and I want to stay with this idea of trust and autonomy. You heard me say at the very beginning of the segment that we're seeing vaccination rates among pregnant people lag in general. It is also the case that there are some subsets of the population that also seem to be at even higher risk. People from Latinx or Black backgrounds are vaccinated at even lower rates, 38% and 26% respectively. We've had a number of conversations here on Radio Boston over these last 2 years about the lack of trust in our healthcare system for people of color, communities of color. Now we're in this space where there's extra vulnerability. How do you take that head on?
Yeah, this is something Dr. Mullen and I have incorporated into this training because I think it's critical. And when you use these conversations well and focus on the individual and really get to the root of their concerns within their context of that community, I think we can face this head on a little bit easier. We do see some lagging rates in those populations that you listed, and there are initiatives to help access information and access the vaccinations to improve those rates, and there has been some improvement. But you're right, those communities are at higher risk, often related to where they're living and where they're working, and we need to, and again, they're dying at higher rates as well. So we see it come through the whole length of the continuum. And again, I think when you come to an individual and talk to them about their specific concerns, you can build that trust. And there have been plenty of inequities perpetuated through systemic racism that distrust of the system is well earned. And so to build that trust back and to respect the autonomy of each individual is really the key part to that.
Professor Daniel Mullen, again, a clinical psychologist, as you're talking about autonomy and trust and the messages that you've been laying out in this training, after after 2 years of doing Ask the Doctors, which is a segment we do on this show where people call in and speak mostly with infectious disease experts and epidemiologists with their questions, over time, since the vaccines have been available, we've heard increasing frustration among people who are vaccinated towards people who are unvaccinated. It's a new fissure in our communities. And it strikes me that there's much that you're saying to healthcare professionals that people could learn from in their own family conversations, in their conversations with loved ones, in their conversations with their neighbors. And I wonder what you have to offer for that broader kitchen table discussion that might be happening anywhere in the Commonwealth right now. I got to believe there's a lot that crosses over.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big question. I guess, you know, I start from a place of thinking that we are all in this together. Whether we like it or not, we're all in this together. And I think we have to start from that spot. I think listening is a starting place. You don't have to agree with the person you listen to, but you absolutely have to hear them out. And then you have to make sure that they understand that you understand them. You have to confirm that you've got it right, that you really understand where they're coming from.
How do you do that?
Well, I mean, there's skills like active listening. A lot of what I'm talking about here is empathy, is to be able to put yourself into the shoes of the individual you're speaking with, to be able to make sure that they can tell that you care about what their lived experience is and what their perspective is. That's a prerequisite for changing just about anyone's mind on any subject, is that you first show that you're interested in where they're starting at and why they believe what they believe.
And then from there, I interrupted your flow when I asked you how you do that part. I think you were going to say
a little bit more. Yeah. I mean, I think, and then you ask them to listen to your perspective after you've heard them out, and you ask them to confirm that they actually understand what you're saying. And throughout the process, you respect that they have to decide for themselves what they want to do. We can't make them comply with our wishes. And when we get into these adversarial relationships where we're really pressuring people to do things they don't want to do, it's really hard to come back from that. And it can drive a big wedge between people.
All right. That is Professor Daniel Mullen, a clinical psychologist, faculty in the Department of Family Medicine and Community Health at UMass Chan Medical School. We've also had Dr. Stacy Potts, faculty in the Department of Family Medicine and Community Health at UMass Chan, and a physician specializing in family medicine with obstetrics. Professor Mullen, thank you.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
And Dr. Potts, thanks to you as well.
Thanks so much for this great discussion.
And that is our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Chris Siderick and Amanda Beeland. We had help today from Sarah Leeson, Francisca Monahan, and Grace Tatter. Marquise Neal is our technical director. Karen Schiffman, our interim executive producer. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Tune in tomorrow for Radio Boston's Week in Review.